We get the hour underway and the show underway this afternoon by welcoming to the show an actor, comedian, writer, director. You know him from shows like The State, Ed, Reno 911, Celebrity Poker Showdown. He's the author of a number of books as well, including a terrific new book called A Better Man, A Mostly Serious Letter to My Son. We are pleased to be joined this afternoon by Michael Ian Black. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rich.
Man, I love this book so much as the dad of a six-year-old. It was such a powerful read and an honest book. And I know it was inspired by your son turning 18, but also by what all of us have been concerned with for many years, and that's this epidemic of school shootings in this country and the fact that what always seems to be a young man.
That's the thing that really jumped out at me after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting, was the fact that it's always a young man. It's always a male pulling the trigger. And I just asked the obvious question, why? Why is it always one sex as opposed to the other? And it seems like such an obvious question, so obvious that I hadn't heard anybody even ask it. So I started asking, and I wrote an op-ed about it for the New York Times. And then I was asked to write a book about being a guy. And so I did. I was reluctant to, because I just felt like, oh, I'm not an expert. What do I know about this stuff? But as you said, I had a son who was about to graduate high school, and I thought maybe I could be of some service to him.
Now, you say in the book that you don't like the term toxic masculinity. Why is that?
Because I don't feel like we have a healthy definition of masculinity to start with. So the term, you can affix any negative term to it, and that'll become the kind of default term for masculinity. So it's not that guys don't display toxic behavior. Of course we do. But because we don't really have a model of what it looks like to just be a healthy man, we don't really know. When you say to somebody like, you know, be a man, which is unfortunately something people say, nobody really can answer what that means. So I don't like the term toxic masculinity because I don't think it contrasts with anything. And I wish we had a healthy masculinity to contrast it with.
You talk about the fact that you didn't really realize maybe that you were a man in all the senses of the word until you became a dad. And boy, that rang true for me. And I came to fatherhood late in life. I was 55 when my son was born. Yeah. And man, you nailed it with that car ride home from the hospital. I have never gripped the steering wheel any tighter in my life than that.
It's a terrifying moment. I mean, you've gone from, you know, not being responsible for a tiny helpless creature to suddenly being entirely responsible for a tiny helpless creature. And yeah, that moment when you just feel like everything is at maximum peril, you've just become a father, and one of your first tasks is transporting your partner and this little newborn home. It's the scariest car ride I think most men will ever have.
You went through a childhood with some challenges in terms of your parents. They broke up. Your dad was, I think, like a lot of dads of that time period, someone who had a hard time saying the words, I love you. You know now that he did. And then you also lost him at a young age. My mom died when I was 12. Your dad died when you were 12. And that's something you never quite recover from.
It's the weird thing about it is that, you know, that was now 37 years ago. And you don't recover from it. I mean, I still feel like I'm wrestling with his death to this day. My mom died 3 years ago after a long illness, and maybe because she was older, maybe because I was older, I still carry her with me, obviously, but her death doesn't haunt me the way his does. And yeah, I mean, the book that I wrote to my son, it's a letter to him. But in a lot of ways, I feel like it's also a letter back to my dad as I talk about what it means for me to be a man, and wishing that I could have had that conversation with him.
Yeah, and without a dad in the picture, when you're going through those incredibly challenging years of being a teenager and body changing and the world changing for you, that kind of leaves it up to yourself. You have to do it alone to figure out at that age what it means to be a man, and who knows then? I barely know now.
Well, I think that's true to a certain extent. I also think that there are plenty of single-parent households headed by women that raise perfectly great men, and women who give a lot of advice and inspiration to boys as they become men. I also think that it is important to have male role models in your life. I didn't really have that. I grew up, my parents divorced, as you said, because my mom became involved with another woman. So I grew up in a lesbian household, which could have been fine. As it happened, that relationship was abusive in a lot of ways. And they were both very angry a lot of the time. And in particular, a lot of their anger was directed at men in general. So I grew up with a kind of, if you will, toxic femininity that had a lot of anger towards men. And while I consider myself like just a dyed-in-the-wool ardent feminist, the feminism that I think they were displaying or trying to display wasn't really that healthy. So I grew up with a lot of like mixed emotions about being a guy, and really had to struggle a long time to just kind of figure out like how to be comfortable in my own skin.
We're talking with Michael Ian Black about his new book, A Better Man. You discussed the importance of empathy. How do we teach that to young men and young women, for that matter? Is it about modeling? How does that work best?
I think modeling absolutely is important. Model the behavior that you want to see in your kids. That's not always easy. You know, it's the old do as I say, not as I, or do as I, what is it? Do as I say, not as I do. You know, when we point out our own hypocrisies. I've been thinking a lot about how to teach empathy. And the best answer that I can come up with right now, and I'm sure there are better answers out there because I'm not an expert, is to start with something that everybody has it within their capacity to do, which is simply to listen, simply to listen and take at face value what other people are telling you. If they're telling you they're in pain, if they're telling you they're experiencing something, hear them without being defensive about whatever it is. Understand that most people are telling you the truth most of the time. And if you can just sort of take their words and hear their experience, I think any functioning human being will naturally feel empathy for whatever they're going through. Because in essence, we all go through the same stuff time and time again. So if we can take that moment and hear somebody, I think that's the doorway to empathy.
Can you explain what you mean in the book? I thought this was a really interesting phrase. You said there are more ways to be a woman than there are to be a man.
Yeah, because we are so, we've spent the last 50 or 60 years, because of feminism, expanding the notion of what a woman can be in this world. We have been teaching girls and young women correctly that they can be anything, that they can do anything, that they can be empowered and strong, but also be nurturing and also be mothers and also be whatever they want to be. That's great. That's a really welcome message that was missing for young women for so long. But the model for guys hasn't really expanded in the same way. We still teach guys, we want you to be strong, we want you to be tough, we want you to be independent, but we don't necessarily give guys the same space to be nurturers, to be carers, to be to be empathetic. And so the ways to be a guy are in a way more constricted than there are ways to be women. And all I'm doing in this book is saying, let's open that up. Let's expand the definition of masculinity to include those attributes and traits that we so often give to women, but don't give to men.
Well, you say manhood is usually thought of as a grim business. And when you talk about no sissy stuff, suck it up. I laughed out loud in reading that because I've said many times through the years, I'm in many ways glad that I was not born with the macho gene. I never felt the need, at least as much as some others did, to prove that kind of thing. And I have a terrible tolerance for pain. I still do today. I don't like pain. I try to avoid it whenever I can. But that's not the message that we've often given young men.
No, we tell them to be, in a sense, invulnerable. That anytime you demonstrate pain, you're demonstrating weakness, which is the same as basically saying you're being, as I say, a sissy. And that's the first rule in manhood. No sissy stuff. It's a phrase that I stole from a book called The 49% Majority. And it's true for so many of us that if you display any kind of vulnerability or weakness, you're kind of made fun of or mocked or told to be a man or suck it up or whatever it is. And we learn from a very early age to hide our pain. Now, I don't have a problem with like dudes sucking it up at times and women sucking it up at times, because sometimes life sucks and you just have to kind of slog through it, of course. But that doesn't mean that there aren't moments when we can't sort of say to somebody, hey, I'm hurting, I need some help, I need a hand, I need a hug, whatever it is. It doesn't make you any less of a man to say those things. In a lot of ways, it demonstrates a tremendous amount of strength to let your guard down enough to say, I need help.
We talked about violence committed by young men in schools and in other places in this country. And you mentioned that men are more prone to violence, and a lot of that is rooted in different levels of fear.
I think almost all of it is rooted in fear. Yeah, part of it has to do with, you know, just the way men have always behaved in all cultures over the globe, with historically men have been enlisted to protect territory and to provide for others. But rooted in all of that is the idea that somebody is going to take your stuff. Like, that's sort of the fundamental fear that guys feel, like somebody's going to come along and punch you in the face and take all your stuff. But then there's also other fears, like the fear of being thought of as less than. There's the fear of being thought of as, or there's the fear of like losing face. There's so many fears that guys have, because we're so invested in propping up our own invulnerable images that, as I say, like we erect these walls around us to protect ourselves. And most of the time, like those walls aren't doing us much good by the time we get into even adolescence and adulthood. Like I think of it like the trash compactor scene in Star Wars, where the walls just start closing in and we're just stuck in this muck.
I love your idea of the infinite axis of manliness. I need that in a graph.
It would be a very long graph. The infinite axis of manliness is just like imaginary line that you could assign anything from this planet and put it on that line according to how macho or manly it is. And what's funny is everybody can do this because we all speak this language so fluently. We all understand, for example, that drinking coffee is somehow more macho than drinking tea. Why should that be? But we know that it's the case. We know that certain colors are more macho. We know that, you know, lifting weights is more macho than jumping rope. Like, we know all of this, and you can think of literally anything and put it on that infinite axis of manliness and have some sense of where it belongs. And chances are, if you ask somebody, they would agree with your assessment of it. It's a strange phenomenon that we all speak this language of masculinity so well, and yet we all struggle to identify in words what it means to be a man.
One of the classic examples of masculinity is the self-made man, and you talk about the mythology of that and how really none of us, especially those who are successful, are self-made.
Yeah, and the phrase comes from the mid-19th century. When a Kentucky senator named Henry Clay was giving a speech on the Senate floor, basically about protectionism for British imports, and I'm going to get this wrong because it's been a few minutes since I looked at it, but he was basically saying we need to protect our self-made men, meaning his Kentucky cotton producers, from the British industrialists who had superior technology at the time. But what he neglected to say was that those fortunes that he was talking about, the self-made men, were all created on the backs of slaves. There was no self-made man, even in the earliest example of the usage of the phrase. It's a funny thing when we think about American mythology and the American self-made man. There don't seem to be very many of them. People who really rose from nothing and attained something remarkable. In fact, even Frederick Douglass, who probably could lay the greatest claim to that title, wrote an essay about the self-made man and said it was all nonsense.
We're talking with Michael Ian Black. His book is A Better Man, A Mostly Serious Letter to My Son. And in raising our sons, you talk about helping them discover meaning and purpose in their lives. But also, that's not enough to really fulfill your destiny as a man and as a person. It's about sharing your inspiration with others and then being open enough to receive their love in return.
Yeah, and this is, I feel like, the crux of it. And it's a hard thing to articulate without it sounding woo-woo and gushy and all of that. But I do think it's true that there's a lot of ways to sort of exist in the world. One of them is as a worker bee, and a lot of guys exist as worker bees, you know, and there's something really admirable about that and important. We do provide and we do protect. We do those things. Women also now provide and protect, but men still see that as a fundamental aspect of who they are. But the more you provide and protect, you start to realize as you mature that you have some more kind of fundamental needs. Some of them end up being spiritual, and I don't necessarily mean in a religious sense, but in the sense that you're yearning for something ineffable, something that's out there that gives your life some shape and meaning. And then below that, I think, is this idea of our ultimate purpose here, which I guess I do believe is to love. And I think a lot of guys are able to give love. We are often able to give of ourselves all that we have. It expresses itself in a lot of different ways. But one thing I think guys have a harder time doing, and that I think is just as important, if not more important, is being open enough to receive the love of others. So often people are trying to give us that love, but because receiving it requires us to lower our defenses, it becomes very hard for us to just welcome what somebody is trying to give. And, you know, love is a kind of, it's a mutually reinforcing activity that we do. And when we're blocked from receiving it, and we also have a harder time giving it.
Just thinking about this as you were talking, and I teach
as
high school.
I was babbling. You can say it.
No. I teach high schoolers, and I always say to them, look, retirement may not be an option for you. The way the world is going, find something to do that you love doing, that you're passionate about, and that inspiration is certainly easier to share with others when it is something you care about. But I wonder too, and you make this great analogy, my son went through his Thomas the Tank Engine phase. And so you talk about being a useful engine, and are young men more inclined to do something on a career path that's going to be more utilitarian, that's going to earn money and help you take care of a family, than to follow that inspiration if it's something, you know, like the world of theater, for instance, that might be a little more dicey?
Yeah, I'm of two minds about this. You know, I'm somebody who went into the theater. I mean, I became an actor, which was always going to be dicey. I always knew it was going to be dicey. And I was willing to accept that risk when I was 16, 17 years old, because, you know, 16, 17 year olds are willing to assume a lot of risk. I think there's a lot to be said for somebody who goes to work at a job that maybe they don't love. They're doing it because they have an obligation to others. I think that's perfectly fine and honorable and good. But I also think we raise boys and girls to a certain extent, but boys especially, by asking them, what are you going to be when you grow up? And we don't ask them, what do you think is going to make you happy when you grow up? Mm. And those are two different questions. They're related, I think, but they're different. One of them is encouraging you to be a worker, to go out there and be a, you know, quote unquote, contributing member of society. And we need that, of course. The other one suggests what you were suggesting, the idea of following what really inspires you and can get you out of bed in the morning with a spring in your step. Those aren't necessarily the same. The answers to those two questions aren't necessarily the same things. And they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. Like, you can be somebody who goes to work as a bookkeeper and in your spare time, you know, you paint Civil War figurines, whatever it is. Those are both important. And we should honor both of those things. And I think we should be asking our kids, what do you think will make you happy when you grow up?
Michael, as a teacher, I want to thank you for your work through the years and your vocal support of responsible gun laws in this country. Having been through some drills that didn't seem like drills with students, nothing is scarier and something wasn't in the job description when we signed up to be teachers, and it's not in the job description as a parent either, to have to tell your kids bad people may want to come do things to you in your school. And I'm so grateful for you being such a vocal spokesman out there for what needs to be done in this country to get us on the right path.
Well, thank you. I wish I was able to do more other than just raise my voice about it. It's an issue that I've been passionate about since Sandy Hook, which happened about half a dozen miles from my house. And I continue to be passionate about it.
Well, the book is an absolutely wonderful read, A Better Man, A Mostly Serious Letter to My Son. It's a great guide for parents of young men and young women as well. I hope Elijah appreciated it as much as we do.
Yeah, he hasn't read it. But, you know, there's always hope that he will. Elijah's my son, to whom it is written. So hopefully he will read it.
Well, it's a terrific book. Michael, thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon. Be well, stay safe, and I hope we can talk again down the road.
Thanks, my pleasure.